the fractures. It's essential to make sure there is no contributing natural cause of death. But the young man proved to be in perfect health, apart, of course, from the fact that he was dead. I was glad when the post-mortem ended and asked myself why the atmosphere had been so unlike other forensic post-mortems I had attended. I won't say they are usually jolly affairs, but there is a camaraderie, or anyway a level of noise or discussion, which was completely absent today. What could the problem be? Back at the office, I started to write my report. Stab wound 1 lay 6 centimetres to the left of the midline on the back. The upper margin of the wound was sharply pointed, the lower margin was blunted. The wound measured 26 millimetres in length. The track of the wound passed between the 5th and 6th ribs of the left hemithorax. The track then entered the left upper lobe on its posterior aspect and passed forwards, slightly downwards and towards the midline. The track transversed the upper lobe of the left lung and incised the left pulmonary artery. This incision was 40 millimetres in length and irregular. Over 1 litre of partly clotted blood was present in the left hemithorax. There was no bruising of the skin adjacent to the wound. So, on the inside of the body, the wound was almost twice as long as it was externally. I included some analysis. The route of the track through the muscles of the back was such that the left arm must have been raised at the time of the injury. The discrepancy between the size of the internal and external injuries suggests movement while the weapon was within the chest cavity. This movement of the knife could have been significant. It certainly indicated that here was a dynamic situation, as many stabbings are. Either the victim or his assailant might have been moving, or they could have been still and the knife itself moved in the wound. Sometimes the significance of such movement only emerges later, so it must be noted. I detailed the 2 other stab wounds and their tracks. They had penetrated only the muscle of the back. Then I numbered the blunt injuries to the left side of the face. There were lacerations, abrasions, and contusions on this body. There were stab wounds, but notably no defense wounds. Classic defense wounds are easy to spot. In a knife attack, the palms and the fingers of the hand can be slashed as the victim attempts to grasp the blade of the knife in a desperate attempt at self-protection. This young man had no defense wounds, but then the main attack had been from behind. Now for my conclusions. That's the part of the report most people turn to first, the part laymen, police, and relatives and so on should be able to understand. I knew the form by now. First, exclude any chance that the victim died from a naturally occurring disease. Next, say what did actually cause death and how quickly the victim might have been expected to die. Then make any useful comment about possible weapons or events or actions that led to the injuries. Finally, give a medical opinion on the cause of death. This is the formal, legal part of the report that will, if it is accepted, appear on the death certificate. I wrote, "Death was not due to natural causes. Stab wound 1 has caused hemorrhage. Death would have occurred in a matter of minutes. The appearance of the wounds is consistent with a weapon, with a single cutting edge approximately 18 to 20 millimetres in width, at a distance of 15 to 17 centimetres from the tip. The weapon must have been at least 15 centimetres in length and most probably had a pointed tip. Both the injuries to the right side and injuries 1 to 4 on the left side of the face are consistent with a blow by or against a flat surface. The possibility that they were caused by collapse onto the roadway is unlikely, but cannot be completely excluded. These injuries appear to have been caused sometime prior to injury 5 on the left side of the face. This injury is consistent with contact with a rough surface. Cause of death, 1A hemorrhage, 1B stab wound to chest. This crime, although no doubt decimating for the victim's family, was actually routine for a forensic pathologist. My report was not the longest or most detailed I have ever written, but I think it took me half the night. Once the lad had been formally identified, I was able to use his name. But apart from that certainty, I experienced self-doubt over every fact, as well as over my deductions. Was I surmising too much? How sure was I that those facial injuries weren't caused when he fell in the road? Should I give possible explanations for why the knife moved in the chest cavity? And did I sound confident enough? I didn't want, once the police had put a man in the dock, counsel for the defence saying, "Tell me, Dr. Shepherd, how many stabbing post-mortems had you carried out entirely alone before this one?" "What? None?" Even though I had only just started my career, I had already understood that court appearances could be a minefield. It was one thing to write your post-mortem report in the office, and quite another to deliver it as an expert witness under fire in court. I'd heard many courtroom stories from older colleagues. I was both looking forward to and dreading my first appearance in the witness box at a Crown Court. The police were soon questioning a suspect in the Croydon stabbing, a man in his 30s, who apparently was not previously known to the victim. The young man had gone to see him at some nearby lock-up garages to buy a cheap, probably stolen, car radio. The police asked me to examine the suspect's version of events, and we agreed that it would be best to do this back at the scene. And so, a couple of days later, accompanied by the same detective superintendent himself, as well as a detective inspector and a detective sergeant, I returned to Croydon. We stood by a dingy row of garages, paint peeled off their doors. The accused is saying somebody else stabbed the lad after he'd left this garage, that he must have been stabbed near to the place we found him, said the super. I said, there was no blood in the garage, so that could be true. They looked disappointed. It was not the last time in my career I would disappoint detectives. Well, we think the accused stabbed him right here, but then there's no bloodstains outside the garages, or in the road, or anywhere but underneath the body. I felt important. I felt like Simpson. Closely followed by the high-ranking officers, I paced the route 100 paces and timed it at the slow speed expected of a dying man who had been stabbed through the lung, 53 seconds, not forgetting to move more and more slowly at the end to allow for his increasing breathlessness and dizziness. I turned to the detectives. You may be right. He could have been stabbed at the garage and got to the road where he was found. They smiled. I wrote, in my opinion, it is entirely possible for an individual with a wound such as injury one to have travelled this distance on foot before collapsing. The lack of bloodstains on the route may be explained by two factors. First, there would have been little external bleeding from an upright individual following injury one until the level of blood within the chest reached the site of the wound in the skin. Second, the deceased was wearing clothing, in particular a thick jacket, which would have absorbed a significant quantity of blood. I need not have worried about my court appearance. The first trial collapsed when the jury was discharged on a technicality before I could give evidence. By the time the case came to trial again, I was a veteran of so many homicides that defense counsel had no idea this had been my very first case. I gave my evidence, and the cross-examination went smoothly enough. It looked clear-cut to me. I had seen the evidence against the defendant and thought it was compelling, and 3 stab wounds, including 1 deep penetration of the victim's lung from behind, gave the tabloids a chance to use one of their favourite phrases, frenzied attack. It was certainly used by the prosecution too, in an attempt to disgust the jury. I was astonished, therefore, when the defendant was acquitted. Evidently the jury had not been convinced of his guilt beyond reasonable doubt. I worried for a while about what had gone wrong and whether, because this was my first case, I had somehow failed to present an effective report. Or had I struck the wrong note with the jury? I would never know. It happened that a couple of years later I was reading the Evening Standard on the bus when I noticed a name which looked familiar in a court report. I read how a slim and attractive young man of about 18 had been knifed by a stranger 3 times. 1 stab wound into the left lung had very nearly proved fatal. By some miracle, the victim had survived to identify his assailant. In fact, he was able to reveal that the man had hung over him and suggested that, since he was dying, a suitable last act might be to have sex. I remembered that very first case of mine. Same defendant. Same crime. Different, but very similar-looking and very lucky victim. I knew about the defendant's earlier murder charge. The jury, of course, did not, when they found him guilty of attempted murder. Chapter 9. My second case was another stabbing. At about 9 o'clock one night, I was called to an ordinary London red brick terraced house, distinguishable from all the other houses in the road only by the presence of the police outside. Inside was an unexpectedly ornate interior. On the banisters, blood. I followed the trail upstairs, and, just inside a bedroom door, feet nearest, naked in a huge puddle of blood, lay a grey-haired man, face down. I pushed the door open. The dull, patterned wallpaper darkened the room, and large, heavy wooden furniture darkened it further. Although cluttered, everything was in its place. The alarm clock, the radio, the framed photos, the small TV on a mahogany chest of drawers facing the bed. Here was the room of a man who led a well-ordered working life. But that well-ordered life had been extinguished, and the working man was lying awash with his own blood. It was difficult to tread round him. His back was patterned with spatters and rivulets of blood. There was blood on the wall. The bed was half covered by a duvet, but this did not hide the huge, deep bloodstains over the sheets. On the floor, by an electrical socket, almost floating in blood, was a long, wooden-handled kitchen knife. I turned the body over with great care. I could see one gaping knife wound in his chest. I thought there were probably more wounds hidden by blood. Then I took his temperature. Since he was already naked, this was easy. Taking a rectal temperature, especially if it involves removing clothes, can create forensic chaos, so I had already learned that quite often it is better to get the body straight to the mortuary and take the temperature there. Now I saw that the victim's temperature was 26.6 degrees centigrade. The detective who was watching me said, "So, Doc, what time did he die exactly?" My heart sank, especially at the word exactly. That's the question everyone asks first. That's the question everyone thinks we can answer. That's the question which reveals the huge gap between the public perception of pathologists and the truth. I blame those TV cop shows. The fact is, it is very hard indeed for us to determine with any accuracy when a death occurred. The detective was waiting. I said, "Well, I can't be sure." Body temperature may be the best forensic indicator we have for estimating the time of death, but it is not a very reliable one. Basic physics tells us that a hot body will cool as its heat passes into the cooler environment. But of course, it's not that simple. A generalization would be that a body feels cold to touch within 8 hours of death. It's not that simple either. In fact, a body may not feel cold for as much as 36 hours, and residual metabolic activity may mean the temperature never drops to the ambient level. Then, when decomposition is underway, the temperature will even start to rise. There are so many variables that can affect the rate at which we cool after death. Body temperature when death occurs, the environmental temperature, fluctuations in the weather, central heating, open windows, the amount of clothing on the body, the TOG value of a duvet over it, the posture of the body. As we all instinctively know, a curled position retains more heat. Body weight, fat is a good insulator. Muscle bulk, less muscle means faster cooling. And the age of the deceased. Children have a larger surface area to body weight and so lose heat more quickly. A multitude of small factors make it a mug's game to estimate the time of death from the temperature of a body. Even a computer program, after taking countless variables into account, would still not be able to give an accurate answer about the time of death. It may suggest that death occurred between a range of times, but those times would probably be many hours apart. And still no one would expect accuracy of more than 90%. The detective nodded wisely. He said, "I expect you'll be able to tell from the rigor mortis." "Well, no, that's another misconception. Rigor mortis is one of death's most obvious processes, but it is so highly variable that it is an even less reliable basis than body temperature for estimating the time of death. Its speed and onset are determined by temperature. A body outside in a cold winter may have no rigor after a week, although there can be a rapid onset of rigor as the body warms up when it's brought into the higher temperature of the mortuary. And there are other confounding factors. Was the deceased exercising just prior to death? Rigor mortis will be faster due to the lactic acid produced by physical exertion. Was death associated with a high fever? Again, rigor will be faster. Was electrocution the cause of death? This speeds up rigor, perhaps because of the stimulation of the muscle cells. Did death take place in front of a warm fire? Faster rigor. In a hot bath? Faster rigor. Rigor mortis is actually caused by complex changes that occur once the heart has stopped beating and the muscle cells are deprived of the oxygen they need in order to metabolize. For years, rigor was assumed to start in the face, as anyone making a delayed attempt at mouth-to-mouth resuscitation may recognize. We now understand that it develops uniformly throughout the body, but that it is simply most detectable in the smaller muscles first. And these small muscles are found mainly in the jaw and around the eyes and fingers. As a generalization, rigor can be felt in these areas about 3 hours after death. It then appears to spread down the body from the head to the legs, although in fact this is just the differential stiffening of larger and larger muscle groups. The stiffening of the muscles generally occurs faster than the body cools, so there is usually a period when the body is both warm and stiff. And it doesn't last forever. Rigor mortis wears off after a day or so, and the muscles become flaccid again. In a temperate climate like the UK, rigor mortis may have affected all of the muscles, fully established rigor, within 12 hours. In hot equatorial regions, rigor can be fully established and then disappear in just 1 hour. And it may sometimes seem that certain people, the very young, the very old, or the emaciated, don't have it at all, because they have so little muscle bulk. Its strength can be surprising. There are famous pictures of full rigor, with the head on one chair and feet on another, and the unsupported body in between as straight as a board. So performing a post-mortem on a body in a state of rigor mortis poses its own problems, unless the deceased has obligingly died on his back with his arms by his sides. The easiest choice is to wait for rigor to pass. Unfortunately, waiting is not an option for the forensic pathologist helping in a homicide investigation, where speed is of the essence. That night, I soon left the blood-filled bedroom for the mortuary. The deceased arrived very shortly after me. His neck, arms, jaw, and knees had rigor mortis, and he had actually died with one arm behind him and one folded in front. His right leg was raised. I needed him to lie flat for the post-mortem, and so I had to break rigor. This can require some strength. If an arm is bent, I must push firmly on the joint until I break the chemical bonds between the molecules of actin and myosin in the cells. Once that bond is broken, the arm can be laid down flat on the table. But sometimes, if the rigor is particularly strong, for instance, if the deceased is a muscled young man whose job involved heavy lifting, I'll need a mortuary assistant to help me. Breaking rigor involves putting considerable pressure on a specific joint to loosen the muscle, and it then gives way gradually, not suddenly like a bone snapping. In this case, the patient was 62 years old, and rigor was quite easily broken by vigorously moving the arms backwards and forwards until they felt loose. At the repeated request of the police officers, I used the two unreliable guides, body temperature and stiffness, to arrive at a range of times between which death might have occurred, bearing in mind that there are any number of variables, of course. In this case, I gave an estimated time since death of 4 to 6 hours. "Well done, Doc," said the senior detective who was just coming into the post-mortem room after taking a phone call. "The bloke who killed him says it was about 4:30, 5 o'clock this afternoon. You've got him already?" "He's just turned himself in. They were in a homosexual relationship. Says he lost his temper." It was quite a serious loss of temper. There were 8 stab wounds, one of them a really gaping wound on the outside, which inside had directly penetrated the heart. So clearly do knives leave their tracks and hilts their bruises that I was able to sketch with detailed dimensions the weapon which had been used by the murderer. It was my first knife sketch ever based on wound tracks, and I was amazed when it exactly matched the dimensions of the kitchen knife the police found at the scene. From now on, Shepherd was a knife man. In addition, although this does seem to me, looking back, like ludicrous over-enthusiasm, I thought I could establish exactly what had happened from the wounds themselves and from the bloodstaining around the room. That was, after all, what Professor Simpson would have done. A telltale spattering on the wall said that the first and fatal injury was inflicted here. The wound was in the left upper chest, and its track was slightly left to right. Classic. This told me that the killer was right-handed, that both he and the victim had been standing, and that he'd used an overarm downward thrust. The victim then collapsed onto the left side of the bed. That was clear from the position of the bloodstains on the sheets, and from the thin lines of blood spattered on the ceiling above, cast-off staining, which is the result of blood flying from the blade's tip as the assailant raises the knife to stab again. It was easy to deduce that the killer had stood over his victim while stabbing him 3 more times. The victim had rolled out of bed and crawled for the door. This was evidence from the trail of blood he had left. The final four stab wounds were almost certainly inflicted here, by the door, where the victim had died in a pool of blood. But the killer might have saved himself the effort. The first thrust was fatal, and after it penetrated his heart, the victim had only minutes to live. The proximity and uniformity of these four wounds, all at the same angle, each a copy of the last, indicated that the victim was motionless by this point, and perhaps already dead. And what about the blood I had seen smeared on the banisters? That had certainly been left by the bloodied, departing boyfriend. It was all over for the victim before he had reached the door. The killer had already confessed, but nevertheless, I was so proud of my deductions that after the post-mortem, I insisted on telling the detective. "Uh-huh," he said, without interest. "Look, you can see here." I held out the helpful diagram I had drawn. He did not take it. Ever eager, I now offered to write a statement explaining my reconstruction of events. He blinked and looked away. "Nah, don't bother, Doc. No one will read it. The blokes coughed." I was greatly disappointed. It was my first inkling that the police really do not want me to play Sherlock Holmes, or even Keith Simpson. My hero was an invaluable part of the crime-solving team in the first half of the 20th century, and was involved throughout homicide investigations at every level, throwing theories around with high-ranking officers or counsel, discussing clues with detectives at the scene. I'd like to do that too. Sometimes I'm bursting to tell the police exactly what my skills and training suggest happened. But police investigation has changed. The science of homicide has now become such a specialized business that the many disciplines involved offer their separate facts, and the police coordinate everyone's findings and come to their own conclusions. That can work, as long as the officers are skilled and experienced. Next, the decision to charge or not is made by Crown Prosecution Service lawyers. Fine, as long as the lawyers don't struggle when confronted by complex medical issues. I think the system would be most effective if we could all sit down together when a case is difficult and complicated. The police and the CPS with the pathologist, the forensic scientists, the blood spatter specialist, the toxicologist, the ballistics expert, and discuss our facts together. But we seldom do that any longer. Chapter 10. Gradually, crime scenes and postmortems became my working life. I was allocated easy cases to start with. They were all different, but they were all straightforward. Routine, in fact. Except that there is really nothing routine about any crime scene. It's just how we all try to make it seem. A motionless body, sometimes hideously mutilated, lies at the center of a web of bustling, serious professionals who are all engaging fully with it while somehow remaining detached from its horror. And at the edges of this web, at a safe distance, is the grief and shock of the bereaved. Pathologists know that even the most routine cases carry a payload of trauma for someone. At that stage, I was still determined to stay uninvolved in this trauma if I could. I did know, however, that sooner or later, there would have to be an interface with the living. At home, there were growing children and a busy wife. I was a hands-on father. Unusual, perhaps, then, but I had been brought up by a hands-on father myself, and the result was that making time for my children was a bigger priority for me than for many others of my generation. However, I did have to learn how to leave the mortuary behind me at home. I had to forget the sights and smells of the place, forget the homicide victim I had just been examining, and whip off the mask of clinical detachment just as I walked in through the front door to the quotidian world of daylight and children. Of course, that wasn't easy. My mask was securely fixed, and so probably I didn't always remove it successfully. Certainly my wife did have a problem with that. Jen understood why I had to be detached, but she told me scientific detachment was an approach I adopted far too often, at home, in our marriage, which was now under strain. A few years earlier, Jen, who had loved being a nurse and a health visitor, had shyly told me that she had always secretly wanted to be a doctor. She hadn't progressed well at school because her father held extremely conservative, indeed colonial views, on the right sort of jobs for women and the education they required. She was also mildly dyslexic, which had further affected her early educational attainment. I had no doubts about her abilities or her intelligence, and when she told me her ambition, I promised to support her through the long years of hard slog ahead. Now, I was very proud of how she had worked her way through the Open University into a place at my alma mater, University College London. She was already on her way to qualifying as a doctor. But of course, this put us under great pressure of time, of money. I earned a fair salary, but nannies were expensive, and although Jen would be earning one day, she wasn't yet. Quite often, my work clashed with her training, and then one of us had to give way. Our lives were hectic and complicated, and our relationship sagged beneath our loads. A forensic examination of our marriage would reveal clusters of quick discussions, one of us always rushing in as the other rushed out, communication often limited to little more than times, dates, parents' meetings, school sports days, logistics, clinical interaction of that sort. A beautiful summer's Sunday morning. The children, still small, streaking into the garden like arrows as soon as I opened the back door. Me, a fresh-faced pathologist, always at the ready to rush to a crime scene and getting a whoosh of adrenaline if the phone rang when I was on call. Jen, almost a doctor, always studying. I was just about to make breakfast. Outside, the children cried, "Oh no!" The phone was ringing. At this time of the morning, it could only mean one thing. I considered the possibilities. Probably, because it was Sunday, someone had simply died after a Saturday night fight. Upstairs, I knew Jen must be sighing. I imagined her sitting with her elbows on the desk, her head sinking into her hands. I did feel bad. She had been up since the crack of dawn with her books, and I had promised to look after the children today, if the phone didn't ring. But it had, and now Jen was about to take the shrapnel from a drunken brawl. A voice told me that the victim was a young Caucasian male, so there had almost certainly been a pub brawl last night, except for one thing. The caller had identified himself as a detective chief inspector. The detective chief inspector who said, as the call ended, that he would be waiting for me at the mortuary with the detective chief superintendent, top brass. At the weekend, there must be something unusual about this case. "Which mortuary?" asked Jen, getting up from her books. "Westminster?" "Swindon." She did a double take. "Swindon? In Wiltshire?" I nodded. She sighed. "See you this evening, then." When I arrived in Swindon, the two senior detectives were waiting, along with a police officer and the coroner's officer. The mortuary staff handed me a cup of tea and the chief superintendent began. "Young man, over the drink drive limit, took a corner on a country lane badly. His girlfriend was in the front seat and basically, well, have you got her statement, John?" The detective inspector nodded and opened a file. He shuffled through some pages of typing. "So, the lad was working all night on Friday, and he's probably been up all day on Saturday, and he's had a few drinks, so now he's tired and drunk, and it's 6 o'clock. Good light, but the road's a bit damp. He's picked up the girl, and he's taking her back to his place for a cosy Saturday night. They're going round a bend, and the van's coming towards them, and she says..." His finger found its way down the page. I shouted, "Oh my God, Michael, look out." And he immediately jerked the car to the left. Michael's side of the car hit the driver's side of the van. At the time of the impact, I closed my eyes. When I opened them, both vehicles were at a standstill, although there was still glass flying around inside the car. I looked at Michael, and his head was back and his eyes were closed. I thought he was unconscious. I shook him, and he sat bolt upright as if I had just woken him up. I saw the other driver get out, and then this man appeared. I don't know where he came from. He was wearing trousers with no shirt, and he was really brown. He gave the appearance of being a labourer. The chief superintendent said he was actually working in his garden nearby and heard the crash. His colleague nodded and read on. "This man asked if I was all right. Michael got out through the window and walked to the front of the car. He pulled bits off it and kicked it and seemed to be very angry and upset. I was upset too. I was hysterical. Michael was kicking and throwing a paddy. I got out and lit a cigarette and gave one to Michael, and then this man with no shirt said, 'Don't light your cigarettes, there's petrol at the back of the car here.' Michael told him to mind his own business, and the man with no shirt said something to Michael, I didn't hear what, which aggravated him, and then a fight started. The detective stopped reading and looked at me. They both looked at me as if they expected me to say something. 'What actually happened in this fight?' I asked. Michael tried to hit the man with no shirt and missed. The man hit him back, that's all. That can't have been all. Why were they reluctant to tell me more? I asked, well, what does the girlfriend say? The detective read, the man with no shirt clenched his right fist and hit Michael full in the face, either on his nose or his mouth. Another man with streaked hair had pulled up in his car by now, and he got behind Michael and put his arms right round Michael to hold him. And Michael went a funny colour, a purpley red, and passed out. The man let him sort of fall to the floor. The detective stopped reading again, but I knew there was more. Any further description? I prompted. By this time, it was raining heavily. The man with no shirt started shaking Michael quite violently to try and get some response from him. He was saying, come on, get up. But Michael didn't move, and I could see he was really hurt. He looked really poorly. The reddish-purple tinge had faded. They couldn't revive him. An old man in a Sierra stopped and put his jacket on him to keep him warm until the ambulances came. When my ambulance drove away, Michael's ambulance was still there. The chief superintendent took up the story. Never recovered consciousness. Swindon sent him to Oxford for a CT scan, then he came back to Swindon. He died here this morning. He handed me some medical notes from Oxford. I looked at them and nodded. So you want to know whether you've got a road traffic accident on your hands or a homicide? I saw them flinch at the word homicide. I wondered again why we had the top brass here. Was the deceased famous? Especially well connected? The superintendent said, the girlfriend's making a right fuss, saying the bloke with no shirt killed Michael, and now the family's making a big fuss too. I got up. Well, let's take a look at him. Right, said PC Masters as we walked into the room where the young man's body lay waiting for us. This is Michael Ross. I did not recognise the name, but I half expected to recognise the face. There were cuts and bruises, but I could still see that the young man had handsome rock star looks, with thick dark hair curling around his forehead. However, there was nothing familiar about him. How old is he? He's 24. I began to scribble, and when I looked up, saw that the photographer had arrived and was waiting for me to tell him what pictures I wanted. Whole body front, then we'll do close-ups of the face and the neck, and we'll have those bruises on his knees, please. Oh, and this fight he got into, the alleged fight, said the detective chief superintendent quickly. Please photograph the hands so that we can see his knuckles. I scribbled. Recent superficial abrasions, mostly vertical over the forehead, bridge of the nose and left side of the chin. Recent punctate area bruising, 8 by 2 centimetres, lying diagonally over the right lower neck. I marked Michael's wounds on my blank body outlines, then looked closely at his teeth. No sign that he was hit in the mouth, I said. The room seemed to rustle a bit, but when I looked up, everyone was still. There are a number of other old bruises and scars on the body, which I noted, as well as details of Michael's tattoos. His back seemed unmarked. We photographed this, and I then turned him over again and began the post-mortem. The officers watched with stony faces. There is usually at least one who turns green, and this time, surprisingly, it was the super. I'll have to get used to it all over again. I haven't been to one of these for years, he said apologetically. I just come back from the fraud squad. Ever since the young PC had thrown up in the first forensic post-mortem I carried out alone, I'd given a lot of thought to post-mortem revulsion, a condition which can affect anyone whose job requires them to be present. I asked myself why I had never, not once, shared their revulsion. Answer, because I was so fascinated by the workings of the human body in general and my findings in particular. I decided that if I could somehow share this fascination with others in the room, I might be able to help them pass their horror. My theory was that if I could involve them in the proceedings through knowledge and understanding, then they would no longer be helpless, shocked onlookers. The nervous silence in which I conducted my first post-mortem and the nausea of the PC who witnessed it could not have been sheer coincidence. So I had determined that the next time someone present became really upset, I'd put my plan into action by talking. Politely but lamely muttering, are you all right? As the super's cheeks took on a greenish tinge would not do. Adopting what I hoped was a reassuring tone, I said, as some of you will know, I have to check the organs inside the body, not just for injuries from the car crash, not just for damage from the subsequent brawl, but to ascertain that there wasn't some other, less obvious, contributing factor to this death, like natural disease. So I'll be taking a good look at all his organs. The super nodded, rather slowly. The room was silent, as though a blanket had been thrown over it. "Got any music?" I asked the mortuary staff. "Something classical would be nice." They switched on Radio 1. I glanced at the super. Maybe the sound of inane voices would steady his nerves. I did ask them to turn it down a bit, though. Cutting dead skin is like cutting the skin on a chicken joint. Easy if you use a sharp knife. The cut is hampered, if at all, not by its strength, but by the skin's natural elasticity. And as a healthy young man, Michael Ross's skin did have that elasticity. As I sliced through the fat which lies beneath, in all of us to some extent, even someone as slim as Michael, I glanced up. The super was not doing too well. Radio 1 wasn't helping. It was time to start talking again, to test my theory that information, any information, is soothing. I'm nearly into the chest cavity now. From this stage, without impinging on Michael's dignity at all, you could try to forget that we are dissecting a human. You cut meat often enough, and this is no different in colour or consistency. You'll soon see that the liver is like any liver you buy in Sainsbury's. The kidneys too, and this muscle I'm cutting now, well, I always think it's a bit like a good steak. "Chips, anyone?" said the detective inspector jovially. No one replied, but the superintendent tried to nod again, as if we were making polite conversation. However, he could not pursue this convention by meeting my eye, because his own eyes were now fixed on Michael Ross. I continued my work. PC Masters was keen to ignore the boss's discomfort, but the coroner's officer seemed to take a certain amount of pleasure in it. "It's all right, he can't feel a thing," he told the super cheerfully. "Bloody good anaesthetic death." I glanced at the super. Start talking. "Of course, I'll have to look closely at Michael's brain and his neck. According to the medical notes, that's where I should expect to find damage caused by the road traffic accident and by the fight. I mean, alleged fight. But I can only be guided by the notes, not bound by them. I still have to examine every organ carefully in case the doctors miss something." No one in the room, not even the coroner's officer, looked as though the prospect of examining Michael's brain was very attractive. I decided not to even try telling them how fascinating this would be. Michael had been a healthy enough lad, although, despite his young age, a hard-drinking lifestyle was already having its effect. His heart was slightly enlarged and his liver fatty, both probably signs of significant alcohol consumption. I was sure the brain would prove the most interesting organ, and, as expected, when I lifted it out, I found that it was full of blood. The door slammed. I didn't even have to turn round to know who had left the room. I asked the photographer for a picture of the brain whole, knowing that I would have to section it soon to study its histology. I'd probably get a colleague who was an expert in brain pathology to take a look at the slides too. I also needed to carry out a really detailed examination of Michael's neck, far too detailed for this postmortem. So I prepared a fixative in order to transport it. The remaining police officers drew back at the intense smell of the formalin as I turned the body over and carefully removed the neck structures with the accompanying arteries, placing this in a mortuary bucket to make sure I disturb the vertebrae as little as possible. "Glad I drove here. I can put this in the boot," I said, as the mortuary assistant carried the bucket away to seal it. "You never would have taken it on the train," exclaimed PC Masters. "I sometimes have to," I admitted. "It looks a bit strange, but I just hope the other passengers assume I've been out catching tadpoles in the country." Certainly no one would ever guess what's in the bucket, unless they could smell it. "Right then," said the cheerful mortuary assistant. "Cups of tea all round." I went into the locker room to change and wash. The police officers had appropriated the mortuary's bereavement room since it was empty, and I found them here, sitting in a circle, drinking their tea. It was a quiet room, decorated in dull shades. Along one wall was a large tank, two fish swimming up and down it noiselessly. I don't know why there is nearly always a fish tank in bereavement rooms. The chief superintendent's cheeks were deathly pale. He was not so much sitting in his seat as propped up by it, and he was evidently disinclined to speak, glancing at the detective inspector instead. The detective inspector asked, "So, what do you think, Doc?" "It will take a while to get you my full report, because I've a lot of work to do on the brain and the neck to confirm my findings, but I can give you an informal, off-the-record debrief if you like." "Yes, please," he said quickly, exchanging glances with the super. What was it about this case that was causing the top brass so much concern? Well, I don't believe that the punch-up, alleged punch-up, had anything to do with Michael Ross's death. He was killed by the impact of the car accident, I said. The detective inspector tried to stop himself, but he couldn't. He smiled. Even the super, still pale and barely sipping his tea, managed to pull his mouth into an approximation of a grin. Are you sure? The inspector asked happily. How can you be sure? You can see, just by looking at him, that Michael screeched to a halt very suddenly. He's got a seatbelt injury on the right side of his neck to prove it. I believe that the sudden stop caused severe whiplash to the spine. Once his spine was out of alignment, and according to his girlfriend, he was turning the wheel frantically at the time, which might have given his spine an additional rotational problem, the arteries, or at least one of them, running up the sides of the vertebrae, were ruptured. A ruptured artery bleeds into a space around the brain. He had a subarachnoid hemorrhage, and that is what killed him. Whiplash. It was whiplash, said the inspector, beaming at the super. A brain hemorrhage, muttered the super weakly. Caused by impact, the detective finished for him. I said, you can get a subarachnoid hemorrhage for genetic reasons, and I can't 100% rule out a congenital problem yet. But it's also caused by trauma, and in this case the hemorrhage was almost certainly a result of the accident. PC Masters was looking more serious than his bosses. He'd been watching the fish swim up and down their tank. Doc, how do you know the hemorrhage wasn't caused by a trauma in the fight? I mean, alleged fight. If the fight had caused the hemorrhage, then there would have been a lot more soft tissue injury. There's just one bruise on the face, which might have been a blow from a fist. I think it's too minor to have done much, but I'll be checking carefully when I examine the neck. Virtually all the other facial injuries look like windscreen glass to me. The inspector said, but Michael Ross's family is asking how he was able to climb out of the car, walk about, smoke, talk, argue, fight, if he had a brain hemorrhage, until the other bloke, the one with no shirt, hit him. A delayed death is fairly classic for this type of hemorrhage. It can take a few minutes, or even hours sometimes, for blood to spread from the damaged artery up the canal to the skull. He managed to do all those things during the lucidity period that sometimes precedes death from a subarachnoid hemorrhage. They all looked at one another. So you're sure it's nothing to do with the fight? I don't think so. But these hemorrhages are found after both pub brawls and road traffic accidents, so I'll have to do a lot more tests before I can be sure I'm right. I believe the tests will show that Michael was a dying man from the moment of the accident, and the fight made no difference. That's what I thought. The timing, however, was unfortunate, since he seemed to die at the moment the man hit him. I was going to have to work hard to prove my theory, and be prepared to change it, since there was sure to be a second post-mortem. The policemen sat back in their chairs and looked at each other. If you had manslaughter charges lined up against the man with no shirt, I'd drop them now because they probably won't stand up. I suppose you might get him for assault, I offered. They said nothing. I asked, Michael Ross had the looks and liver of a rock star. Is he famous? They shook their heads. So, why do we have a chief superintendent and chief inspector here on a Sunday morning? The super looked at me. So did the inspector, who paused then said, off the record, Doc, we're here because I thought we were in a spot of bother. I waited. The officers looked uncomfortable. Finally, the super spoke. The man with no shirt, the one who hit Michael, he was an off-duty police officer. So that was it. We didn't tell you before because we didn't want to influence you. I said stiffly, you wouldn't have influenced me. Pathology tells its own story. No. That sounded all wrong. Far too pompous. Far too much like someone who was occasionally unnerved by the number of versions of the truth he was beginning to encounter. I added, even if I wanted to ignore inconvenient truths, there's usually a second post-mortem, so I couldn't do that. But the super was not listening. His face, still deathly white and his voice low, he said, you don't know how worried I've been about this one. It would look so bad for the force. And between ourselves, a few things have been said about that officer in the past. He loses his rag, and, of course, we didn't want to believe he killed a man, but his record isn't... Well, anyway, what you've told us is a big relief, Doc. The thing is, said the police constable, who clearly knew the man with no shirt, I can see how it happened. The driver, Michael Ross, he was an idiot to smoke near the car when there was fuel all over the road. And when Mitch told him that, he tried to argue. So Mitch had to make him stop. I can see that. Persuading an RTA victim to behave safely is one thing. Losing your rag with him is another, said the inspector. Now they knew the officer's action had not contributed to the death. They seemed able to discuss the matter. Even the super joined in a little. Are you going to be all right? I asked him as I left. He nodded, but I thought his face still looked pale and drawn. I wondered then if attending a post-mortem could actually be a traumatizing experience. I had to ensure somehow that it wasn't. I'd done my best today. How could I do more? I heard the officers' voices still debating as I walked down the corridor. I drove home with my bucket and its strange cargo in the boot. Pooh, Daddy, you're really smelly, said my daughter. Anna's never been one to mince words. Jen fell gratefully on her books. I made supper and then, when I was no longer on call, allowed the children to persuade me that we should take the dog to the park. I loaded all three into the car. Anna, seatbelt, I said. No. Seatbelt? Don't like my seatbelt. It's not the law to wear a belt, piped up Chris, because we're in the back seat, which in those days was true. It's the law, I said firmly, in this car. Seatbelt, now, or we don't move. Michael Ross was not saved by his seatbelt, but I had already seen many, many fatalities that could have been prevented by wearing one. Travelling without a seatbelt is a risk I would never take. I'm not going to put my seatbelt on, Anna declared. Anyway, it's not fair, because Dilly doesn't have to wear a seatbelt. Dilly wagged her tail. I said, right, then we don't move. And to show how ready and willing I was to sit in the car until she was safely buckled in, I got out my cigarettes, lit one, and proceeded to puff on it until my daughter had fully complied with my health and safety rules. Then we drove to the park. I know, but at least I opened the windows. From this, you will see that my attitude to risk-taking, my own and my children's, has always been as idiosyncratic as everyone else's. At least working with death has helped me recognize it can arrive most unexpectedly, and therefore I do appreciate the good things life has to offer. So that evening, I enjoyed the park. I enjoyed the general laughter while bathing the children, and I enjoyed reading them stories and then kissing them goodnight as they snuggled into bed. Later, Jen took a break and we sat together in the garden. As usual, on a Sunday, we were synchronizing diaries, working out how we were going to manage our various commitments. We couldn't afford after-hours childcare, so each week our time had to be planned and managed. When we had finished, we sat back with our cigarettes. The evening was so still that the smoke rose upwards in a straight line. It was good to relax as the sun went down. And it was inconceivable to us that it might be possible to relax without cigarettes. We were fully aware of the effect of this. I often found myself looking at lungs which bore the strangely beautiful but deadly patina of smoke inhalation. But we regarded cigarettes as an essential part of our full and busy lives. The next day, I did some research into subarachnoid hemorrhages. I found that victims often show aggression in that period when they appear to be recovering, the period between accident and death during which Michael Ross had started fighting. And alcohol, which frequently plays a role in these hemorrhages, can certainly make matters worse by increasing blood pressure and making rupture of any damaged area more likely. It seemed Michael was a textbook case, but I still had a lot of work to do. I not only had to x-ray the whiplash injury to the spine, but I had to take a series of cross-sections of the spine's arteries to find the resulting rupture and show how it had caused the hemorrhage. The chief superintendent phoned me. Michael Ross's family wants another post-mortem. They think we're closing ranks, and they say that if we don't charge the off-duty police officer with manslaughter, they'll file a civil case against him. Did you explain that I found? They weren't interested in hearing anything from me. They've got their own pathologist. That's not unusual. He named the pathologist the family was consulting. I was pleased. Oh, I know him, and he's very good. The super sounded less pleased. Wants to do his post-mortem the day after tomorrow. I'll be there. When there is a second post-mortem, and there often is, for example, Lawyers defending clients on a murder charge frequently call for one. It's normal, but not required, for the first pathologist to be present. I thought it would be both useful and interesting to watch a post-mortem performed by this esteemed colleague. Before the second post-mortem, I examined the brain further, reassuring myself that there was no congenital aneurysm that had caused the hemorrhage. And I continued with my slow and careful dissection of the vertebral arteries, photographing every step of the way until I found the rupture which had caused the hemorrhage. I sent specimens and photos to the Ross family's forensic pathologist and to another neuropathological expert who was also coming to the second post-mortem. Afterwards, the expert and the family's pathologist conferred and then wrote a detailed report that confirmed all my results. The pathologist agreed that whiplash, caused not just by Michael's sudden braking, but his frantic turning of the steering wheel, had dislocated his spine. This dislocation ruptured an artery carrying blood to the brain, resulting in a hemorrhage. He said, "The walking about, smoking, talking, arguing and fighting may have accelerated the rate of hemorrhage, but I doubt very much whether the fatal outcome could have been avoided. After a few minutes, the amount of hemorrhage became such that Mr. Ross lost consciousness, and from then on, the fatal outcome was inevitable." My post-mortem had pleased the police, and the cause of death was certainly beyond dispute when the second post-mortem concurred. But supposing the forensic evidence had not been so clear-cut, and the police had put pressure on me to exonerate their officer. A slight adjustment in wording at the end of a report, "There is a possibility that," to "It is unlikely that," can be enough for the Crown Prosecution Service to bring charges or to drop them. How hard would it have been to resist such pressure if it came from the Met, fostered by the hopes and fears of individuals I worked with on a regular and friendly basis? I reminded myself that I became a forensic pathologist to be a seeker of the truth. That meant I must stand up for the truth, whatever pressure I was placed under to massage it. I see now that this is just the sort of noble thought a keen young man of limited experience might have. I had not worked on enough cases to know how malleable a concept truth is for some people, nor how open to interpretation, instinct and inclination are all truths, even those that appear to be scientific fact. Although there had already been some intimations of truth's elasticity, in court for instance, but overall I was still deluding myself that it was always possible to find a moral pathway that everyone would recognize as clear and correct. Chapter 11. Someone had to go and speak to a CID training course, and I was pleased it was my turn. There are a lot of police courses, and officers have no choice about attending, but some make it obvious they would rather be playing golf or even out on the job than sitting in a lecture hall. I was sure of getting their attention today, however, because my subject was the human body after death. The police are seldom present when someone dies. They inevitably arrive after the event, sometimes a long time afterwards. This lecture was designed to help them recognize what they might find. I began by explaining that death is a process, and when that process, dying, is complete, it sets off another series of processes which eventually return us to the earth and complete the life cycle. The screen lit up above me and the police officers stretched out their legs. A few sipped their coffee and relaxed, with the air of men settling down with their wives to watch a David Attenborough wildlife documentary. I didn't want to give them too much science, so I simply said that oxygen is vital for almost all cells. It facilitates the cell's multitude of life-sustaining chemical reactions. This is metabolism. On death, when there is no oxygen, muscle cells rapidly become flaccid. They may, for some hours, still respond to touch, or the discharge of a dying motor neuron cell, or other forms of stimulation. As a result, disconcertingly, limbs may even twitch in a lifeless body. The eyelids may close, or more often half close, because muscles in the eyelid are too flaccid to complete the movement. The response to light is lost. However, there is a myth in some cultures, predominantly Asian, but also in the West, that the eyes retain the final image they see, so exposing the face of their killer. This was considered as a scientific possibility in Europe in the 1870s. It was called optography, and experiments were performed on individuals before and after execution, but without success. Despite the lack of any scientific proof, the concept took root in the public imagination, thanks in part to authors such as Rudyard Kipling and Jules Verne, who used it in short stories. The idea even featured in an episode of Doctor Who in the 1970s. Once cemented in the public psyche, it has been very difficult to remove. Another old wives' tale is that hair continues to grow after death. In fact, the cells in hair follicles die with the rest of the skin. The skin, if the deceased is Caucasian, becomes pale on death because blood is not circulating and blood pressure is lost. The rings of muscle that control the passage of food and liquid through the digestive system lose their tone, which means that, depending on both the angle of the body and the individual's internal organs, urine may leak out. Feces also, but this is less common because of the structure of the rectum. Another common leak is that of semen, so it is never safe for the pathologist to assume, on finding semen outside the body, that the deceased had sex just before he died, although he might have done. And just because gastric contents are found in the mouth, there can be no assumption that vomiting was a cause of death, since regurgitation is found in about 25% of postmortems. The police officers really did not need reminding that death can be a messy business. They knew that bodies often leak from orifices in a way their owners would find shameful in life. In fact, I long ago understood, after talking to people about their end-of-life fears, that this undignified leakage is something many find worrying about death. But I believe there is no need for anxiety. Those of us who choose to work with the dead are non-judgmental and respectful, and I feel that worriers really won't care about this when life is actually draining away from them. I think they will be entirely involved in the process of letting go and giving up their bodies. Embarrassment is just the kind of worldly concern which I believe the dying relinquish, often perhaps with relief. The next process after death is cooling. I could have devoted an entire lecture to this subject, but I offered only the most general of guidelines. I wanted the police officers to recognize how unrealistic TV movies are about judging the time of death accurately from a body's temperature. The next process is the stiffening of the muscles known as rigor mortis. They were familiar with that one. Then I showed pictures of hypostasis. On death, blood stops circulating and its components, cells, and protein become subject to the normal laws of gravity, which means that the red blood cells sink and settle in the lowest areas of the body. The tiny blood vessels in the skin in those areas then become distended by blood. This makes the skin initially appear pink, but within 5 or 6 hours it turns a very angry color, bright pink with a bluish tinge. And here is the paint box we call hypostasis. Its alarming appearance is heightened in Caucasians by the great whiteness of adjacent parts of the body, those which are pressed against a firm surface, a bed or the floor perhaps, where the blood vessels are squashed flat and so cannot fill. These areas stay bunched. A Caucasian who dies lying in bed, therefore, has hypostasis staining most of the skin on the back, as well as the back of the neck, thighs and lower legs, and very white skin on the buttocks, as well as white patches over the shoulders. In darker-skinned people, hypostasis is, of course, still present, but its appearance is much less livid. Hypostasis does eventually disappear, but only when the blood is dispersed by the final process after death. This process is decomposition. Many people find the idea of decomposition repellent. It might help to remember that this is an important, natural process that completes the life cycle of the human body and returns it to the chemical pool that is the earth. It is hard to imagine what our world would be like without the ultimately cleansing process of decomposition, smelly and ugly though it may seem to the living. There are 3 ways a body can decompose: by putrefaction, mummification, or adipocere, of which putrefaction is by far the most common. I had brought pictures, and the officers seemed unaffected by those I had shown so far, but I watched them sit up now, hoping, I guessed, they wouldn't have to look at putrefaction. But a putrefying body is simply one in which the soft tissues are turning slowly to liquid. The speed of this process, of course, depends on temperature. In the UK, bodies will usually start to putrefy around 3 or 4 days after death, and this will be visible to the naked eye quickly. I showed a picture of a body and, with a pointer, drew the officer's attention to one small area of green discoloration just on the right side of the lower abdomen. "It's usually just there," I said. "That's where you'll first see putrefaction. Our guts are full of bacteria, which are vital for digestion. Now, in death, those bacteria